It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement released its latest batch of nationwide detention statistics this week.
Congress requires the Department of Homeland Security to release data on immigration detention every 2 weeks, but this is the first time they've done so in months.
An investigative data reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel analyzed the numbers for Wisconsin. She found that ICE is detaining more people in Wisconsin jails, and most of the people detained have no criminal convictions.
For more on her reporting, Eva Wen joins us now. Eva, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
You found an increase in the number of people ICE is detaining in Wisconsin jails. How big an increase did you see?
Yeah, so before we dive into the numbers, it's important to note that these are average daily populations in detention centers in Wisconsin, not the total number of people ICE has detained through the year. So given that, on a given day, there were around 115 from 2023 to 2025, but close to 150 in 2026. So that's about a 25% increase.
And according to the data, more than half the people detained in Wisconsin have no convictions. How do we see that trend comparing to previous years?
Yeah, so there are about 60% of people held in detention in Wisconsin that don't have criminal records. That's actually the case under both Trump and Biden administration over Biden's past last 2 years of his presidency, barring the pandemic. So that is somewhat interesting because, you know, the arrest numbers show that Trump administration is arresting a lot more people without criminal convictions. However, many of these people arrested are being sent under Trump to other states, detention centers in other states, so they may not show up in the data in Wisconsin.
And ICE detainees who are not sent to detention centers out of state are held in a handful of Wisconsin jails that have entered into an agreement with the federal government. What have we seen change there over the last couple of years when it comes to how many and which Wisconsin facilities are detaining people?
Yeah, so from 2020 to 2024, it used to be just Dodge County Jail. That was the only county jail that was holding immigrant detainees for ICE. But now, since the beginning of the Trump administration, we have seen three other county jails joining that. That includes Douglas County Jail, which is near the border with Minnesota, Waukesha County Jail, and Sauk County Jail.
You also published an analysis of tactics used by ICE agents in a major immigration crackdown at the end of June, looking at videos taken by bystanders. What kind of things did you find out?
Yeah, so in some of those videos, you know, you see a lot of use of force. You see agents breaking car windows right away once they stop someone. Some pointed guns and tasers at people that appeared to be cooperating. And quite a few videos also showed agents pinning people on the ground or against walls. More than half of those agents were masked, although some were not. And a lot of them did not have vests that said anything other than police.
Eva, thanks for sharing your reporting with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Eva Wen, investigative data reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She analyzed the data released earlier this week by the federal government on immigration detentions in Wisconsin. Now we're joined by an immigration attorney here in the state who has a perspective on what these developments look like for the people being arrested and detained. Aisa Olivares is a partner at Eastbridge Law Group in Madison. She's also legal director at the Community Immigration Law Center. Aisa, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
We just heard the numbers there. Now, as an immigration attorney, you're talking directly with people affected. What kind of things have you heard about how ICE arrests and detentions are evolving?
I think we're hearing about an increase in different tactics and violence being used by ICE in order to execute their arrests across the state. And we see people who have no criminal history, mothers who are breastfeeding, people with disabilities, elderly individuals as well. And so the population certainly in these facilities are growing and it's diversifying to include many different sects of our community.
There's been an ongoing question about if someone is detained by immigration enforcement, do they have the right to appeal? Do they have the right to be out on bond? The U.S. Department of Justice's Board of Immigration Appeals ruled no last summer. It's still going through the courts to decide on that. What does that mean right now? If someone is detained, can they seek a bond to be released? What is involved in doing that?
Yeah, so definitely what it means for the people right now detained here in Wisconsin and in the Seventh Circuit is that people are experiencing prolonged detention. They are not necessarily eligible for bond in the way they were before September of last year when the interpretation of the law by the Department of Homeland Security changed to say, you're not eligible for bond, actually. And so you have no chance to go before an immigration judge to have them assess dangerousness and flight risk so that you can be released to your family in the interim of these proceedings. You have to go to federal court to obtain federal habeas corpus petitions in order to have a right to that bond hearing.
And now, if someone is detained, they might be in the midst of an immigration process, right? They might be in the midst of, say, an asylum filing or something like that. When they're detained, what happens to those proceedings?
So many people actually that we are seeing are in the middle of their proceedings and have done everything they're supposed to. They've checked in with ICE. They've been monitored on an alternative to detention, and they've submitted their applications. But they find themselves now in a detention facility with proceedings being expedited, possibility of not having access to your lawyer in the same way you did when you were not detained. And now the need to get together crucial evidence that's going to determine your case in just a couple of weeks.
How do you decide whether someone might be able to challenge their detention in front of a judge? And then once you start that procedure, how long does it usually take?
So we meet with individuals at the facility and we do a quick assessment about whether they would be bond eligible if they were given a bond hearing. And so we do assess eligibility for bond. There are certain things that would make you ineligible. If they're eligible, we do proceed with that federal habeas corpus petition, but we're up against the clock. The immigration judges are under a lot of pressure from the Department of Justice to move forward very swiftly with people's removal. And so oftentimes we're not getting decisions on these federal court petitions and able to get somebody released before there's a decision on their case.
Now, as we just heard from Eva, some people are detained in Wisconsin in jails, a handful of them around the state. Many others, though, are detained elsewhere in the country. Does being moved out of state create additional hurdles or barriers as people seek to be represented either for a bond hearing or for their ongoing immigration proceedings?
We are seeing people from Wisconsin transferred outside of the jurisdiction in Kansas, Kentucky, and Indiana. It means that they're farther from family. They're farther oftentimes from their lawyer or from legal representation. And the conditions vary across all of these facilities. But some of these facilities are outside of the Seventh Circuit and might have favorable case law around a bond hearing. And so what we're seeing is that we're able to move more swiftly and more quickly toward reunification of a family if they're transferred outside of the Seventh Circuit.
And you mentioned the Seventh Circuit, the regional court circuit that would deal with these cases. What's the status of legal challenges to that federal ruling that says, yeah, no, you don't have the right to seek bond?
We were hoping, because there was, some information that came down about expediting this oral argument, that we might have a decision this summer, but it's been delayed. There hasn't been a lot of movement. We are hopeful that it will come down soon and in a positive way so that people in Wisconsin will have access to bond hearings.
There had been questions at various points over the last couple of years of, if someone is detained, can we find them? Can their families know where they are? Can the attorneys, if any, connected to their case, find them? What are you seeing when it comes to that?
It can be difficult. Sometimes it takes days to find somebody. Oftentimes we're getting this information from family members because people are given a phone call and they're able to advise about where they're being taken to or where they might be transferred to. And so we really rely heavily on our families for this type of information so that we can locate people before they're inside officially of the system and try and schedule a confidential phone call so that we can speak with them about what their rights are in that facility.
Over the past decade, I think, there have been concerns, protests when Wisconsin jails enter into contracts with ICE, say, people saying, no, don't work with them. There has been an argument saying, well, hey, people are closer to home. They're closer to family, potentially. Is there a benefit to having facilities cooperate with ICE for these detentions and keep people here in the state?
I mean, of course, there's a benefit to being close to counsel and close to nonprofits that are doing the work. But unfortunately, I think any cooperation with ICE and jail space means increased detention and really facilitating the increased arrests that we're seeing here in Wisconsin.
So if ICE says, oh, we would have to transport a person elsewhere in the country, maybe that's too much bother, they might be less likely to enforce if they don't have a local detention facility?
I believe that might come into their discretion on whether or not to arrest, because there is a lot of discretion involved on the side of ICE. And we're seeing now how many more people, you know, don't have criminal convictions, how many more people are being held in the state of Wisconsin. And I think it's this cooperation that allows for that expansion.
In a situation where someone has been arrested and detained by ICE, what kind of things should be the first actions that they or their family members would take to keep in touch, to try to minimize detention time and get a fair hearing for their immigration procedures?
So I think it's important for people to know and have discussions with their family about what this could look like. Oftentimes, you are able to ask questions of ICE to make a phone call to ask them where you're being taken to so that you can share these details with your family. You're given a case number right away. That case number helps lawyers to find out where you are in the posture of your proceedings and get important information to determine whether or not you might be bond eligible.
On a legal, philosophical level, there have been arguments, does due process apply to someone in the country without a legal status? What would you say to people who say, well, there shouldn't be due process because these aren't citizens we're talking about?
Sure. So due process is part of the Constitution, and the Constitution covers people regardless of their immigration status, and it protects us from the arbitrary exercise of power by the government. And unfortunately, the mass detention and deportation agenda has significantly escalated the lack of due process for people, because they are placed into an expedited proceeding, they are in detention, and it can be really difficult to access legal representation. At a bare minimum, people facing deportation should be able to understand the proceeding against them in a language that they understand, alongside somebody who understands immigration law. And due process is an essential safeguard to our country's fundamental democratic values as we work to advance immigration policies that respect fairness, family unity, and human dignity.
Aissa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Aissa Olivares is a partner at Eastbridge Law Group in Madison and legal director at the Community Immigration Law Center. We also heard from Eva Nguyen, data reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, find out how wildfire smoke affected outdoor tourism in northern Wisconsin and zoo animals in Milwaukee.
We take care of small reptiles to our largest elephants. So it really depends on the species and their habitat of what that plan is going to look like.
That's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Democrat Joel Brennan says he can win Wisconsin's governor's race if only voters get a chance to know him.
Brennan is a former cabinet secretary for Governor Tony Evers, who has plenty of experience in government, but he's struggling to stand out in his first ever run for political office. Corrine Hess has this profile.
On a recent Friday, Joel Brennan visits his local coffee shop. The brightly lit cafe is buzzing with customers. Brennan must know a dozen people here. As soon as he walks in the door, a friend of Brennan's tells him he saw his new campaign ad.
You know, first of all, when I heard your voice, I was working out. I paid more attention. And then I saw you, then I turned it off.
Moments later, Brennan turns around and is chatting with someone else.
Hi, I'm Joe Phillips.
Joe, how are you?
This is the version of Joel Brennan he wishes more people could see. A likable, everyday guy. Someone who can fill the shoes of Governor Tony Evers, his old boss. He's making his first run for office in a year when Wisconsin Democrats have had plenty of candidates and drama. What Brennan is hoping to convey is that he's a safe choice to take on Republican Tom Tiffany in November. He points to his experience as Secretary of the Department of Administration. It's a catch-all agency that manages everything from Wisconsin's Capitol building to billions of dollars in federal aid.
And having done it during the time when we've had as big a public health crisis as there has been in my lifetime, the biggest economic crisis that we've had over the course of the last 100 years, there are ways to prove that you have the mettle to do the job, and I've done it.
Brennan got his first taste of politics knocking on doors for Tom Barrett when he was running for re-election to the state legislature. Brennan went on to work on Barrett's campaigns for Congress and governor. Now in retirement, after serving as Milwaukee's mayor for nearly 20 years, Barrett is campaigning for Brennan.
He's got the skills that are necessary to be a great governor. He has the values, and I think first and foremost, you have to have a person with strong values. And he's really, I think, exemplified those values throughout his career.
Brennan started his campaign with a folksy approach. One of his ads features his wife and kids, who say his strengths include that he's a hard worker.
No weaknesses.
Dad jokes.
Dance moves.
Did you mention his clothes?
Early polling showed his messaging was not resonating. Barry Burden heads the Elections Research Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says Brennan's pitch comes at a time when many Democrats are moving to the left.
They'd really like to take back all the state government and push it in a more progressive direction. And Joel Brennan doesn't convey that idea as much as the other candidates do.
Burden says this primary is also historically diverse. He says that puts Brennan in an unusual position as the only white man running in the race for Democrats. In recent weeks, Brennan has tried new ways to stand out. When Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez's campaign imploded this month, Brennan was the first to attack. Now he is running a new ad. It starts with a video of his Democratic opponents, Francesca Hong, Mandela Barnes, and David Crawley.
She's a proud socialist. He lost statewide before. A couple weeks ago, he dropped out.
The ad says all three would lose in November. Brennan's argument is that he doesn't have the same baggage. The aggressive campaign shows a different side of Brennan than he started with. As the first-time candidate tries to introduce himself to tens of thousands of voters before the August primary. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR will continue our series on the governor's race Monday with a profile of Democrat Mandela Barnes. This is WPR News.
Last week, a thick blanket of smoke from Canada and Minnesota wildfires triggered hazardous air quality alerts across much of Wisconsin, the Great Lakes, and the Northeast.
In Minnesota, wildfires and smoke prompted an evacuation of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness.
Officials estimate that the wildfires could continue to burn in that area until the first snowfall.
The particulate pollution and visibility-blocking haze impacted outdoor activities and tourism businesses.
For a look at how conditions were around the Apostle Islands, we turn to Savannah and Sean Campbell, owner-operators of Northern Lights Adventures, Boat Charters and Tours in Bayfield. Savannah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us, Rob.
And Sean, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Rob.
As we speak on Monday, it looks like your air quality in Bayfield has gotten better, but I know that part of the state got the smoke the first and the worst. What was it like for you when it hit, especially on Thursday and Friday?
Well, it was quite shocking, actually. Visibility was down to only a few hundred feet, you know, out there in the Apostle Islands on the boat. You see the islands. That's the goal, right? Well, couldn't really see them anymore unless you got very close. And the air quality was not great as far as your lungs and your throat and your eyes. So we were using masks and we were offering masks to our guests. And so far, nobody has canceled on us. But it's been much better over the last few days. Visibility is probably a few miles now, as of yesterday, at least when I was out last.
Now, you're in a part of the state that counts on a lot of tourism in the summer. You mentioned the people are already there. Well, they kept their tours. Is there concern for you and other business owners that people might have been scared away from booking plans, at least till they see how this wildfire smoke shakes out?
Definitely. There is a lot of concern. In fact, a lot of other places have already canceled tours and, over the safety of their workers and guests.
Does it make, your way around the Apostles at this point. Did it make it weird to kind of navigate, given that your visibility wasn't what you were used to?
Yes. I mean, we're using electronic chart plotters and things, but it definitely was more difficult to navigate. You know, you're trying to figure out, okay, where's the shallow parts next to the islands you're trying to stay away from, but still see some of the stuff that you want to see.
And you mentioned you had the masks there. Were your customers taking you up on those, or were they just breathing and hoping for the best?
It seemed like some of the older guests were taking part in that, but some of the younger ones, they really didn't want to use them. I mean, it's been hot too, mm-hmm. as far as the temperature goes. So it's difficult to keep the mask on for long periods of time.
And of course, you're somebody who's going to be watching the weather, of course. How often do you have, forget the smoke for a minute, how often do you have weather conditions of one sort or another that make you have to postpone or even cancel some of your trips?
I would say, I mean, this year I've only canceled maybe a handful, but probably about 10% of the trips that I do yearly, I have to cancel due to weather.
Now, you're somebody, of course, who lives in that area as well. Have you had plans that you've had to modify because of the smoke?
Absolutely.
What kind of things?
We're going to go to the Big Top Chautauqua. They had a Queen cover band called Killer Queen on Saturday night. And we, after we got done with our double trip, we were going to go over there and have a meal with some friends, and they had to cancel that last minute. I don't know if they identified the reason for canceling it, but I do think it was because of the smoke.
Yeah, and Savannah, I wanted to hear your perspective now on the smoke. This is something that I didn't grow up with, certainly. How weird and unique is this for you?
Yeah, hi, thanks, Rob. Savannah Campbell, I cooperate Northern Lights Adventures with my husband, Sean. He does primarily the fishing on the boat, and I do some of the land tours in the Apostle Islands and nearby. I've lived here all my life, and you know, just these last couple of years is all I can really remember. I don't remember this as a youth, having to consider the wind direction for the smoke forecasts. So definitely a different phenomenon here for me.
And how has this affected the land tours? I mean, a lot of great scenery, I know, on the on land, on the Apostle Islands. Well, what has this meant for the people you're taking on tours?
You know, it's one thing for Sean to take people out on the boat and they're primarily sitting down, you know, maybe reeling, you know, when you're reeling some fish in, there's a little bit of respiratory effort there. But last year I canceled a couple of land trips because we are doing some hiking and I did not want to I didn't want the clients to feel obligated to have to do the trip. I just refunded their deposits because I don't want people having to do a lot of respiratory effort when we're looking at the air forecast, like on airnow.gov, and it's saying hazardous. Even, you know, any person, regardless of their health status, should not be out in that. So we didn't want to expose people or risk having people get sick or injured from the smoke.
Now, I got to say, I'm somebody who I don't have any of those pre-existing conditions where I'm at particular risk. I've definitely felt it being out and about. You're both people who work outside. Being outside for your tour shift all day, do you feel it, Sean, in your lungs at all?
Definitely. And my eyes, too. I mean, the back of your throat kind of burns after a while. You do kind of get used to the smell, though. I noticed that couple of days after the smoke had showed up, I wasn't really smelling the smoke anymore, even though you couldn't see still.
And Savannah, how about you doing the land tours?
Yeah, same thing. I don't know if I'm just getting used to it or if some of the more fire-like particles that you're smelling, like a bonfire, just kind of settle and there's just still that haze. But I can only imagine that there's a lot of stuff in the air that's, you know, microscopic particles that it's still not good to be breathing in.
Now, I just want to take a moment before I let you go. Apart from the smoke, how has your season been so far, this key tourist season in the Bayfield area, Savannah?
Really good, actually. Now being part of the National Park Service with our commercial use authorization, there's, I think, a little bit more visibility there for our clients. We have people coming from Wisconsin and Minnesota primarily, but we have people really from all over the country and all over the world we've seen on the boat from other different countries as well over the years. We've been doing this now for just under 10 years. And so, yeah, it's the business is good. And we certainly hope that, you know, we already have some weather to contend with, strong winds sometimes pick up or lightning storms. Hopefully we're not going to see this smoke being just another thing that we have to contend with as far as being able to get people out in nature and seeing the beauty and the, you know, the geologic wonder of this area. So we do really feel for those who are directly impacted. You know, this seems like really a secondary thing, but it does really make you wonder. It's kind of similar territory around here with all the trees, and we hope to never have to experience firsthand any of these fires. So,
thank you both for joining us, and best of luck to avoid that smoke the rest of the season.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Sean and Savannah Campbell with Northern Lights Adventures Boat Charters and Tours in Bayfield, giving an update about how smoke from wildfires in Canada and the Boundary Waters are affecting their business. Now, the smoke from the wildfires last week sent air quality danger levels off the charts, with some of the most unhealthy levels in the world. As public health officials advise many humans to stay indoors through the smoky conditions, what about the animals that largely live outside? Joining us now to discuss how the state's largest zoo navigates through these air quality challenges, we have Tracy Dolphin, Director of Animal Management and Health at the Milwaukee County Zoo. Tracy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, when you see this smoke coming in and the air quality alerts shifting into unhealthy or even hazardous, what kind of planning, what kind of action goes into effect for your team at the zoo?
So we already have some plans in place, getting ready for, you know, the air quality and the conditions that we're going to be experiencing. And really, we don't have a one size fits all for all of our animals. I mean, we take care of small reptiles to our largest elephants. So it really depends on the species and their habitat of what that plan is going to look like. So some of the things we really think about is, do our animals have any pre-existing conditions? You know, any cardiac, any respiratory? Are they more sensitive? Those animals are going to be definitely moved inside. Our great apes, primates, our flamingos, we're all brought inside. Then we look at animals that may be a little bit older. Are they going through any active illness? Anybody is immune compromised? We'll make sure that they are in their indoor space as well. And then any of our spaces that are conditioned and have better air quality inside, we would bring our animals in. So like our big cats, our bongos, were inside their barns Thursday and Friday. They had better air quality. Some of our barns are outdoors, so the inside and outside wasn't much different. So those animals stayed outside and we had our keepers monitoring them. We have keeper staff here 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So we are always monitoring our animals and we can tell if anything is going on with them. And then our last is we have animals that are outside, and at their period of time, it'd be more stressful for them to move to an indoor space. So we allow them to stay in their habitats. And again, we just monitor them as well. So we really have, again, that multi-tiered approach to really deliver the best care and approach to all the individualized animals here at the zoo.
You mentioned the great apes, our closest relatives, being some of the most severely affected potentially. What is it about them that makes them particularly vulnerable?
Yeah, and some of our great apes are a little bit more prone to cardiac or respiratory illness. So we want to make sure that they are in their indoor space during these times when our air quality is poor.
I'm guessing this was not a big issue for Midwestern zookeepers in years past. How have you seen things change when it comes to the risk of wildfire smoke for your zoo animals?
Over the past few years, we've been seeing more and more conditions like this. So we have to make sure we have our plans in place to, you know, keep our animals safe, but also keep our staff safe during these times as well.
Yeah. What kind of things are you doing for the humans at the zoo?
Absolutely. So again, if, you know, our staff does need to be outside at times, and so wearing masks. So masks were hand out, and if they were outside, they were wearing masks. But also we did cancel where if our staff had to be outside all day, we went ahead and canceled those. So some of our animal in action, our giraffe feedings, we closed our goat yard. And that was really for our staff so that they weren't outside all day as well. Here at the zoo, though, we have so many indoor spaces because we're year round. So for winter, we have indoor spaces. So many of our guests that chose to come out, we still did have the zoo open and they were able to enjoy the animals from our indoor areas.
Is this something where you can tap into expertise from other zoos, maybe in California, that have a lot more history with dealing with smoke like this?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a huge network of experts that we can rely on. And get a gauge as well.
How do you watch for symptoms of smoke exposure when you have so many different species, as you mentioned, from maybe small lizards up to really big mammals? It seems like there'd be a lot of different potential health conditions to be monitoring there.
Correct. And so it's not a one thing that we're going to look for across the board. It really depends on the species and what that species would be showing us. So we have a lot of animal care specialists that really know their animals really well. So they can really notice the smallest change in those animals.
I know when my kids were younger, we did a lot of programs at the local zoo through the summer. Has the smoke affected the kind of outreach operations that your colleagues at the zoo are doing and the summer programs happening there?
It did. It impacted, some of the programs where, like I said, our animal in action, the kids were indoors. So it did impact for a couple days. Yes, definitely.
And have you gotten in the habit now of watching not just the weather forecast, but those smoke forecasts? You know what you're watching for all the species at your zoo.
Yes, we actively watch for many different warnings and are prepared for just about anything that will come our way.
Tracy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Tracy Dolphin directs Animal Management and Health at the Milwaukee County Zoo. Earlier, we heard from Sean and Savannah Campbell, owner-operators of Northern Lights Adventures Boat Charters and Tours in Bayfield. We talk about the wildfires in Canada and the Boundary Waters and how the smoke has impacted the health and well-being of people, animals, and local businesses and the tourism industry.
Coming up, a country folk band from La Crosse, Mr. Blink, is out with a new album celebrating the people and places of Wisconsin.
You're reminiscing about all the awesome things in the state of Wisconsin. You know, we fish through the ice. We're Wisconsin nice. That's Wisconsin right there.
A preview of the album called Ope Mountain. That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A country folk band from La Crosse is out with a new album celebrating the people and places of Wisconsin.
Ope Mountain is the new record from Mr. Blink, an award-winning musical group who've been playing together for nearly 40 years, starting back in their college days.
They call their style of music Big River Rhythm Rock. We'll get to hear the Big River sound of that label in just a bit.
Mike Cockett is lead vocalist, guitarist, and songwriter for Mr. Blink, and his wife Nancy Cockett plays multiple instruments and sings backup vocals for the band. Mike and Nancy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Kate.
Yeah, thanks. It's good to be here.
Mike, your new album, it really embraces the people and places of Wisconsin. What inspired you to go all in on Wisconsin lore for this effort?
I just had a lot of songs that were similar and had different topics about people. And we decided, let's just make it a theme album. And not many people do that these days. They're all about singles, but it came out good. Very happy with it.
A theme album. What do you love about Wisconsin? What made it easy to write songs about the state?
Well, everyone in the band is from Wisconsin, born here. I was born in England. My dad is from Madison. And so when he retired, we moved to Madison. And I just kind of leaned into, okay, this is where from now, Wisconsin. So I signed up for Packer tickets, and after 30 years, I got them, and just really decided this is where I'm gonna put my roots down and raise a family. And it's been a great state. And I'm considered an immigrant because I was born in a village in England. And so as an immigrant to Wisconsin, I wanted to especially the song In Wisconsin, like as a love letter to the state and its people and just how much it is that we love it here.
Well, let's just play a moment of In Wisconsin here. And this is a thank you to the state for giving you a place to set down roots.
Yes.
In Wisconsin, come right on. How you been? You're among friends in Wisconsin. Come right on in.
This song, In Wisconsin, let's talk about it. This is a thank you to the state for giving you a place to set down roots. What are some of the emotions, Mike, that come up for you in the song?
I think as Wisconsin, people and the politics of Wisconsin, sometimes it doesn't really represent who we really are. You know, we should be welcoming immigrants. We should be, you know, we're a blend of all tribes. You know, we're not just one type of people or race. And, you know, with even the first natives, you know, that we're all in it together.
Musically, Nancy, how do you want us to feel that inviting sense of Wisconsin in the musical sense of the song?
Well, I think, you know, the backup vocals especially just add to this because it just seems to grow when we get to the chorus portions. And then it kind of comes back down and you're reminiscing again about all the awesome things in the state of Wisconsin. You know, we fish through the ice. We're Wisconsin nice. I mean, that's Wisconsin right there.
Nancy, you and Mike are founding members of Mr. Blink. How did the band go from a group of college friends to now having this nearly 40-year legacy together?
Yeah. Well, we formed in 1989, and we all just loved playing music together so much. And Mike has kept everything really fresh for us because he constantly changes. He can memorize lyrics.
I think the longevity is part because of our diversity and our not pigeonholed into one type of music. Hmm. You know, we call ourselves polyjamorous. Because we'll do all kinds of music. And we have 5 albums, and you can't really put a label on us because I don't think we want a label. Because then you're making music for marketing purposes and not just the joy of making music, you know. And so we are country. We are Americana. We have a bluegrass song, and right in the middle of a bluegrass song called Paul Bunyan, there's a reggae section.
Yes.
You know, so it's stuff like that. We have horn sections. We have a fiddle. We have backup singers. And it gives us a freedom to, like, do whatever comes out of us, really.
I also felt a little bit of Acadiana influences, a little Cajun influences at some points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Little mm-hmm. Irish influence.
Yeah. Nancy, how has the band's sound evolved over time? What have you noticed?
Well, we first started kind of as a jam band and did some Grateful Dead, some reggae, and just as kind of a summer project. And over time, Mike has written lots of music, and he throws it out to the band, and we all start playing, and he allows us to really have that creative freedom to do what we would like to and offer suggestions for the songs. And that's just grown over the years, no matter if what type of formation of the band. You know, we've had horns for a little while, and then we didn't have horns. We had 2 keyboard players. We just really have evolved, and now we're almost coming full circle.
How big is this band now?
It's 11-piece, sometimes 10-piece, mm-hmm. sometimes it's a 8-piece, sometimes it's a 4-piece, sometimes it's just me.
But it sounds like you really want to hear your musicians out. You want people to have a say in what the band puts together.
Right. It's a community. It's better when we do things together. Like, you know, like in the Hope Mountain song, the quote from Paul Wellstone, "We all do better when we all do better." And it's more fun when we're all in it together.
I'm gonna climb Hope Mountain, I'm gonna stand upon that rock. I don't care if life's not fair, stop that negative talk. You can try and keep me down, I'm not staying on the ground. I will
here is this reference in the song to the late U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone, a line from that 1999 speech, "We all do better when we all do better." You just said it. Why did you include this quote, Mike?
It just resonated with me as far as my own political beliefs where, you know, if we all do a little bit, it'll add up to a lot, and we all should – every decision we should make politically should be for the common good.
Hmm. What about the title Ope Mountain? Because the album kicks off with the song Hope Mountain, adding an H. How did we get to Ope?
Well, it was Jesse, our fiddle player, her idea, you know. And so it just, I think the H is implied in the title. And a lot of people don't even know what Ope is, even though they've probably said it all their lives. So I think it's just a funny way of wrapping it all into like the, you know, Minnesota, Wisconsin geographic.
I do feel in the song, you're trying to lift us up. You're trying to help us find the hope in each of our circumstances. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I'm an optimist, you know, and I think the gifts that you are given, you should use those to lift people up. And so my songs, I don't know, even sad songs like Peshtigo, you know, there's elements of heroism in that song. And I just think, man, we need more hope, right? Mm. Can't have too much hope. Can't have too much love.
We're talking with Mike and Nancy Cockett from the La Crosse-based band Mr. Blink. They're out with a new album. It's called Ope Mountain. Nancy, Mr. Blink has been playing together in La Crosse for decades now. What is the music scene like there along the Mississippi River?
We have a great music scene. There's many places to play and a pretty supportive audience. Several places we can play in town that offer us the opportunity to do all originals or covers. And I just really think the arts here are supported by the community and all portions of arts, classical.
Yeah, there's something about a river town also that it's a lively place. You know, back in the old days, you know, with the lumberjacks and the traders, this is where they went, down the river, to get their entertainment and excitement.
It sounds like your band feels supported in the community, feels very welcome.
Yeah, I think so. You know, we do other things. We do a thing called a Hopi Hour, where we just play for free and what, pick a charity or a person to, you know, donate money to, put in a bucket. Mm. And yeah, we like it here, and they like us here, I hope.
You hope, and you made a song for La Crosse on this new album. Let's take a listen to that.
I'm going down, down, down to Rivertown. All my friends will be there. I'll buy them all around. The nights will be longer. Time will be smaller. The days will be stronger. Wherever you lost will be found. In
Mike, tell us more about this tribute to La Crosse.
Well, the nights will be longer. That is in reference to the old bar time. It used to be 2 o'clock, it used to be 2:30, and so you just yeah. Rivertown, it's a love letter to La Crosse. You know, I'd written other songs, but this was about La Crosse. But this was one. It's like you know, I like it here. I'm going to write a song just to make everyone feel what it is to be here. And you know,
Nancy, you play a variety of instruments for the band, including the Irish flute. What is special to you about this instrument in particular?
Yeah, well, we did a Pogues tribute a few years back, and that's when I first started getting interested in it and started playing in it. It just has a magical tone that just goes right into your body and vibrates mm-hmm. through it, and it just feels so good.
How did you learn how to play the Irish flute?
I studied flute in high school, played in our high school band. But otherwise, that was really the only experience. And just listening, Mike and I had the opportunity to go to Ireland last summer, and I watched all the Irish flute players, and it just was fun.
Yeah, she brought an accordion over there, too. She's going to learn that for the next album.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Well, Nancy, you just line up these instruments, including a Leslie speaker.
Oh,
can you explain what a Leslie speaker is and how it modulates your sound?
Yes. So a Leslie is a big amplifier that any instrument can play through, but mostly organs have gone through them. And so it's a big wooden cabinet, probably 3x3. Really pretty heavy. I have a vintage Leslie 45, and there's a big speaker that faces down, and when you press a button, there's an oscillator that goes around and around, and it kind of makes the sound go wubba 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 wubba. And that can go fast or slow. And it is just, again, you feel that in your bones, in your body, and I just love the way it sounds.
Mike, how do you layer that into the album? Where does it fit in?
Usually it's the foundation. You know, it provides, like, other things to lay on top of it. You know, it reminds me of, like, a tabernacle choir organ or something sometimes where it just comes in and just, like, lifts everything up a little bit.
Nancy, what do you appreciate about adding all of the backup sound for the band and layering in these elements?
Yeah. Well, by nature, I'm kind of a helper. And so I think having that foundation is something that can change how the song sounds. Without it, you would miss it. With it, you sometimes don't even know how much it's helping until you heard it without it. Mm. Yeah.
Mr. Blink will be kicking off a tour soon, bringing these songs to communities around the state. Nancy, what are you most excited for as you take Oat Mountain on the road and show it off to audiences?
Oh, just the songs are so amazing about Wisconsin that I want to share with every community, especially if it was more specific to that community, this the greatness that they have in their town.
How about for you, Mike?
Well, I remember Woody Guthrie once said that he can't write all the songs. So he has to go to your local songwriter and have them, like, write the songs that are in that area. And so I think it's going to be exciting, like, to play, you know, the song about Tom's burned down bar on Madeline Island, or to go to Peshtigo or play there or some, maybe at the festival or bar or even in the park, you know, or down to Madison. We have a song about increased slave room and, you know, play there. And there's a song about cheese. Plymouth in Door County is like the cheese capital of Wisconsin, self-proclaimed. But to go play there, you know.
You've got a lot of miles ahead of you here with this album.
Yeah.
Well, Mike and Nancy, thank you for sharing the band with us. Mr. Blink, appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
That is Mike and Nancy Cockett from the band Mr. Blink, and they joined us from WPR's La Crosse studio. We've been talking about their new album, Oat Mountain, and we're going out on the song In Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin, how you been? You're among friends in Wisconsin.
Here on the show, we heard about a big horseshoe competition in Marathon County, and next week we'll check out the World Cornhole Championship. That's in South Carolina. We'll hear from some of the bag throwers representing Wisconsin.
And meanwhile, we want to hear from you. What is your favorite lawn game for this time of year, even if you don't play at a highly competitive level? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. Once again, the number 888-642-0232.
Whether it's horseshoes or cornhole or ladder toss or coob, I was just at an outdoor wedding that had all four of those. Again, email us, wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or call or text to get in touch. The number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Royce Padeswa, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.